From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, our guests are Alice Horwitz and Myron Oloukian. We will be discussing oral health and dental care, one of the more neglected areas of public health. Then, later in our opinion segment, Paul Zeitz will be joining us to discuss the Bush administration proposal to increase international aid designated for the AIDS epidemic. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our first news item today concerns what appears to be a new form of highly infectious and severe pneumonia. The World Health Organization has issued a travel advisory due to the rapid spread of what appears to be a new infectious respiratory disease. The syndrome, which has been given the rather nondescript name severe acute respiratory syndrome, has infected at least 150 people so far with 12 deaths, one of whom was a U.S. citizen. Most of the reports of the illness have occurred in 9 countries in East Asia, but one case occurred in Canada. And on March 15th, a patient who appeared to be suffering from the syndrome was removed from an airline flight from New York to Frankfurt, Germany. The exact nature of the infection is still under investigation, but it is not caused by any infectious agent easily identifiable using traditional techniques of microbiology. Symptoms of the disease include fever, muscle aches, cough, and difficulty breathing. Travelers who develop these symptoms are advised not to undertake further travel until they have recovered, and appropriate isolation and testing procedures have been undertaken. There are currently no indications to restrict the onward travel of healthy passengers, but all passengers and crew are advised to seek medical attention if they develop symptoms. There's currently no indication to provide passengers and crew with any medication unless they become ill. Until more is known about the organism that causes the illness, disinfection procedures for aircraft have not been changed. The illness again highlights the importance of international health cooperation through organizations such as the World Health Organization. Listeners desiring further information can go to the World Health Organization's website, who.int. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to hear a case that will determine whether federal courts will temporarily administer the Texas Medicaid program for children. During the 1990s, Texas was repeatedly found to be providing inadequate assistance to indigent families, including 1.5 million children. The state was failing to inform patients of available services and treatments. Many children in the state remained unenrolled because the Medicaid department made little effort to help them enroll. After obliging 35% of the Medicaid patients to enroll their children in Medicaid-managed care, many of these managed care plans were found to be systematically denying children access to specialists and profiting from that denial of care. The CHIP program, developed during the Clinton administration, provides funds for children living in families who are low income but not quite poor enough to qualify for Medicaid. Currently, all 50 states participate in the CHIP program. In another story coming from the state of Texas, several key members of the Texas House Appropriations Subcommittee on Health and Human Services have proposed to help reduce the state's $10 billion budget deficit by entirely eliminating the state's CHIP program. Eliminating the program would save the state approximately $428 million over the next 2 years. In doing so, the state would forfeit about $1 billion in federal matching funds. The CHIP program in Texas currently provides health insurance to just over 500,000 children. Virtually all of these children would end up without health insurance if the CHIP program is eliminated. Discontinuation of the children's insurance program is also under consideration by the state legislatures in Missouri and Florida. Continuing with the Medicaid program, this time in the state of Nebraska, 10,500 Nebraskans will be losing Medicaid coverage in an effort by the state to save over $17 million. Advocacy groups working on behalf of these individuals had argued that some sort of transitional medical coverage should be provided, as occurs in many other insurance programs. But that argument was rejected by the U.S. District Court judge, and these 10,000 people will soon be losing their health insurance coverage. While the plight of the 42 million or so Americans who have no health insurance whatever sometimes achieve media attention, an increasingly common problem which receives far less attention is the problem of underinsurance. Policies with extremely high deductibles are increasingly common. Often deductibles are set so high that for patients with low household income, there is effectively no benefit from having health insurance. An article in the March 12th issue of the Wall Street Journal provided another angle on underinsurance. The article describes the increasing number of policies which exclude critical aspects of treatment. In an attempt to hold down costs, employers are opting for policies that would cover a bone marrow transplant, but not the costs related to the transplant's donor. Other policies cover treatment for breast cancer, but if a second tumor develops in the other breast, treatment of that second cancer is not covered by the insurance. Other policies specifically exclude pacemakers, even if the necessity for them is urgent. The treatment of several forms of hepatitis and Crohn's disease now include expensive drugs, and a number of policies exclude these treatments, even when the insurance company agrees that they're medically necessary. Many governors and state legislators across the country have been lobbying the Bush administration to divert funds from his proposed $674 billion tax cut to come to the aid of state governments. 43 of the 50 states have very significant budget deficits. This has prompted many states to enact tax increases and program cuts, some of which we've already discussed. According to a National Association of County and City Health Officials report released last month, approximately half of the 539 health departments they surveyed have delayed or canceled clinics that care for patients with sexually transmitted diseases, checkups for low-income children, children's dental care, and other traditional public health programs. As state and local officials have begun cutting budgets, prenatal care, HIV prevention, and tuberculosis tracking have all been cut to provide funding and staffing for smallpox vaccination. Adverse impacts on the public health have already occurred. Alonzo Plo, the Seattle Public Health Department's director, notes that his department is scrambling to curb an increase in sexually transmitted diseases in his community. Cuts in his department and diversion of infectious disease staff to the smallpox program prevented a timely, effective response. Health officials around the country are even more concerned about the smallpox program's second stage, which calls for 10 million police, fire, and rescue workers to be vaccinated, a prospect that is overwhelming many health officials. The full report is available online at the NACCHO.org website. Later in today's show, Paul Zeitz provides an opinion piece assessing President Bush's proposed increase in global AIDS funding to $15 billion over the next 5 years. But since recording that segment 10 days ago, a new obstacle has delayed the authorization of that aid. The issue is whether a policy which has been labeled the Mexico City policy should apply to the new funds. The policy bars U.S. money from international groups that support abortion. Even if the abortion-related activities are not being supported by the U.S. aid money. Abortion-related activity was defined to mean not only performing abortion, but even discussing abortion with patients. The policy got its label as the Mexico City policy because it was originally announced by President Ronald Reagan in Mexico City in 1984. That policy was removed by President Clinton, but George W. Bush reinstated the policy on the first day of his presidency. Critics of the policy have noted that if applied, it will hobble programs that are in the best position to fight the HIV epidemic. Especially important would be the cutoff of funds from local clinics that provide family planning and maternal health services to women. Many women would be denied the chance to learn about HIV from their regular health providers who are located close to home. An editorial last week in the respected British journal The Lancet points out that imposing onerous restrictions on HIV programs at a time when the epidemic is taking 8,000 lives every day and causing 13,000 new infections every day is a policy that should not be considered pro-life. More on the Bush administration's HIV proposal later in today's show. Coming up next, oral health in America. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Diseases of the oral cavity, especially cancer and dental diseases, are among the most neglected areas in public health. Dental diseases, severe enough to result in loss of many or all teeth, remains widespread, despite the fact that these diseases are largely preventable, with interventions that are not particularly expensive. Joining us today to discuss these issues are Myron Aloukian and Alice Horowitz. Dr. Aloukian received his dental training at the University of Pennsylvania and his public health training at Harvard School of Public Health. He is the Director of Oral Health for the Boston Public Health Commission. He served on the Dental Advisory Committees for Healthy People 2000 and Healthy People 2010, documents which establish national objectives for our healthcare system. Dr. Aloukian is a past president of the American Public Health Association, only the second dentist to have achieved that honor. Alice Horowitz received training as a dental hygienist at the University of Iowa and further training in health education at the University of Maryland. She has devoted much of her career to public health dentistry, much of that at the National Institute for Dental and Craniofacial Health, where she currently serves as a senior scientist for health policy analysis and development. During this broadcast, we will frequently refer to the Surgeon General's Report on Oral Health in America, published in the year 2000. This is a unique compilation of our achievements in the area of oral health and the challenges that remain. And it's easily found starting at the National Institutes of Health website, nih.gov. Drs. Horowitz and Aloukian, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you very much, Marvin.
Well, thank you. I enjoy having this opportunity.
I'd like to start out by having you describe what you view as some of the major dental problems and oral problems that affect people at different stages of the life cycle.
I think the major dilemma we have in this country in terms of oral health is that we have what I call a neglected epidemic. We have a disease that affects almost everyone at almost every age. Many people are not able to get dental care, and they're suffering unnecessarily from this disease, which they need not have. For example, when you look at 17-year-olds, 78% of 17-year-olds have had tooth decay with an average of 7 affected tooth surfaces. When you look at individuals age 40 to 44, 98% have had tooth decay. When you look at people 65 and over, roughly 30% have no teeth whatsoever. And I'm talking primarily now about tooth decay.
What other problems are significant enough to mention, in the top 3 or 4?
Oral cancer. And we know from data that the majority of adults in the U.S. do not know that oral cancer or mouth cancer is even possible. And it is a cancer that has basically been ignored for decades. The survival rate at 5 years is one of the lowest of any major cancers. It hovers right around about 50%. Now, this is outrageous, particularly when one can have an oral cancer exam, you know, by a dentist, hygienist, or other providers, and yet the majority of adults in the U.S. have never had an oral cancer exam. Certainly, periodontal disease is another one of those. And the majority of people, by the time they hit mid-20s, likely have some kind of gingivitis, which can advance into periodontal disease. And this is the condition that is most likely to cause people to lose their teeth and things like this.
Now, people often think of dental issues as being a very separate problem, unrelated to one's general health and well-being. But I know the Surgeon General came out with a report a few years ago, which I know you folks want to talk about, that takes issue with that concept. So I'd like to ask you both, how are oral health and one's general health related?
Well, I think it's unfortunate in this country that we've essentially separated the head and the mouth from the rest of the body. For example, if you get an infection on your arm or your leg, you usually have health insurance to pay for that. But if you get an infection in your mouth, a significant percentage of the population does not have dental insurance to pay for infections or abscesses in the mouth, though they do for the rest of the body. And that's unfortunate because the head and the mouth is part of the body, and if you have poor oral health, it could affect your general health, your nutrition, digestion, speech, social mobility, employability, your self-image and esteem. It affects your quality of life and well-being in general. There have been some studies that have showed a relationship between gum disease and premature low-birth babies. There have been other studies that have shown a relationship between oral infections and heart disease. So there are a variety of ways that oral health affects quality of life and well-being. I mean, no one likes to be in pain and infection, and whether it's in the mouth or the rest of the body, it should be dealt with. It shouldn't be separated out. A number of years ago, I was doing a screening, and looking in a child's mouth, I saw the child had an abscess with pus coming out of the abscess during the screening. And I called the mother over and showed it to her, and she was shocked. And she said, you know, she said, my daughter hasn't been sleeping. She's been irritable. She's not been eating for a number of weeks. She said, no wonder when I see that. So, you know, it can have a very direct impact.
Can you describe the interaction between dental health and nutrition?
Well, there are probably two major ways. The primary one would be that in order for there to be dental caries or tooth decay, that there has to be three things. There has to be a susceptible tooth. There has to be refined carbohydrates, and there have to be certain bacteria. So here, certainly, refined carbohydrates, or mainly sugars, are extremely deleterious and are certainly part of the whole causal chain for this. The other thing is, although much less information, is that like with other cancers, that a low intake of fruits and vegetables apparently is a risk factor for oral or mouth cancers.
Now, the Surgeon General's report on oral health also notes the social and cultural importance of maintaining oral health. And I have to confess, when I think of public health, I don't think of that as being an important consequence. But the text there is really persuasive about that. And I was wondering if you can describe some of the social effects of having bad dentition.
If someone has rotten teeth, they're not going to get the job that requires them to interact with other people.
Yeah, I think there's from the social acceptability perspective, I think one would only have to go to a magazine rack of popular magazines and take a look at both males and females on the cover. And they're universally, they have this gorgeous white smile. So that's just part of the American culture right now, and I think not having that may very well make some people feel self-conscious and not feel that their quality of life is as good as others. So I think it can have an impact,
it affects,
even though it is basically aesthetics. You know?
It does affect self-esteem and self-image.
And if they smell bad, that's going to be rather unappealing, too.
Oh, that's even worse. You know, and that's part of it. I mean, if you have gum disease or tooth decay, you're going to have an odor in your mouth.
Now, I'd like to turn our attention to what factors can help to maintain good oral health. And one way I've thought about dividing this up would be to look at things individuals can do themselves, things that the society as a whole has to do, and then what the dentist can offer to maintain oral health. And I guess, how about if we start out by talking about individual, what can the individual do to protect their oral health?
Use a fluoride toothpaste regularly, and remove plaque would take care of two things. Would help prevent gingivitis and perhaps ultimately periodontal disease. In addition to that, clearly the fluoride toothpaste would help prevent tooth decay.
The use of mouth guards is very important in contact sports. Fractured teeth, broken teeth, and chipped teeth occurs a fair amount in kids who are in contact sports. Now, there are some guidelines by national athletic organizations that it's required, say, for football and hockey, but it's not required for other sports such as soccer and wrestling and basketball.
And smoking would come up as also important, I assume.
Oh, definitely.
Oh, absolutely.
Definitely.
You know, the use of tobacco is, a huge no-no. And unfortunately, the tobacco industry has focused on kids. I mean, the tobacco industry loses its best customer because over 400,000 Americans die a year from tobacco use, and 90% of new smokers or people who smoke have begun by the age of 19. So even though the tobacco industry says, well, we're not marketing to children, they are marketing to children in a variety of different ways. And also decrease in number of role models on tobacco. For example, spit tobacco, which is used by a significant number of kids in this country. For years, the baseball players were sort of role models for the use of spit tobacco. And the dental profession, through a variety of mechanisms, has sensitized baseball players about the fact that, one, spit tobacco causes oral cancer, and two, that by being role models for kids, lots of kids were taking up spit tobacco because their hero baseball players were using it. And there's been an excellent program going on for a number of years with baseball players to educate this to them and to get them to be more careful in terms of this type of behavior.
When you mentioned earlier the importance of refined carbohydrates, mostly sugars, in promoting decay, it occurred to me that the media have been carrying a tremendous amount of information lately on obesity, especially among young people,
exactly.
Children and adolescents.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't heard anything from an oral health point of view. And I'd like to ask you, what types of social level or governmental level interventions might occur to try to get some of the soft drinks and other types of harmful foods to focus on their importance to oral health, too?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an excellent question, of course, and there is tremendous amount of effort going into trying to get particularly soft drinks out of schools, and especially elementary schools, K through 6. I don't think they have done too much beyond that age level, but several states have taken action, certainly a lot of local communities have taken action to accomplish this. And of course, we run into big problems here in this arena because the soft drink industry has sort of purchased many school systems by being able to sell only their product in a given school, and then in turn, they give a lot of money to the school for you know, band uniforms, all kinds of equipment and things like that. Schools are in dire need financially. But it's an area that I think is only going to grow and be discussed. Same thing is true with foods out of vending machines or being sold over the counter in schools, that many schools are regulating what percent of sugar can be in foods to be sold in schools to these kids of this age. So it's a very, very hot topic.
Now, when people talk about social and governmental level interventions, the most classic one is fluoridation of the water. And I was wondering if you would comment on the extent to which research shows that to be useful.
I'd be happy to do that. Fluoridation, in my mind, is the foundation for better oral health for any community, whether we're talking about a neighborhood, a city, state, or country. If you want to make an impact on improving the oral health of people, any population group, you have to have community water fluoridation. Now, you need a public water supply for that, and if you have a community that doesn't have a public water supply, then you can't do it. But we should have every public water supply in this country fluoridated. There are about 162 million Americans living in fluoridated communities in this country, and there are about maybe 90 to 100 million who could be in fluoridated communities who aren't. And it's a question of really making it a priority in the community, giving the decision makers the facts and information so that they're willing to move ahead to improve the quality of life for the people in that community. And that has made an enormous impact. It's the most cost-effective preventive measure we have in oral health, and everyone in the community ultimately benefits from water fluoridation, so there's less pain, less disease, less suffering, and lower bills. And all of this for maybe 60 or 70 cents per person per year. It's a fantastic bargain. As a matter of fact, the Centers for Disease Control cited this as one of the major achievements of the 20th century in public health.
And it's caries that are being prevented? It's not the other issues like gum disease?
Yes, tooth decay.
Yeah.
Now, so far we've talked for a while and have yet to mention the importance of going to the dentist. And so I'd like to turn our attention now to that. You mentioned three major oral health problems that affect very large numbers of Americans.
Yes.
And so the importance of the early diagnosis of oral cancer is clear. But can one expect to have less likelihood of both gum disease and caries by getting regular dental cleanings and such interventions? Are cleanings specifically a useful intervention?
Cleanings are to help reduce periodontal disease. But again, that gets back to the individual needs. There's not a blanket recommendation. However, there certainly are recommendations as far as the frequency of having, say, topical applications of fluoride, which are also important, particularly in non-fluoridated communities.
And also dental sealants.
Exactly.
Dental sealants are an excellent preventive measure for tooth decay on the most important teeth in the mouth, the molars.
Now, I'd like at this point to talk about the dental workforce in the U.S. Do you have concerns about the dentists and hygienists and whether there are enough of them or whether they're distributed according to social needs?
We find that in most major urban areas, there are plenty of them in certain sections of the city, and in the low-income sections, there are very few of them. And then in rural areas, there's a problem, and in remote areas, there's a problem. Not only do you have to be in the right geographic location, you need the money to pay for the service. If you're low income in Boston and you're an adult and you're on Medicaid and you need dentures, they just stop paying for dentures in this state for people on Medicaid, adults. So, you know, these folks are in a tough spot.
Are there enough minorities?
No, there aren't.
Clearly are not.
Yeah, there are definitely not enough minorities. When you look at the general population of this country, we have roughly 12% of the general population are African Americans. In terms of the dental workforce, it's only about 2% of dentists. We need more Native American dentists. We could have more Hispanics going into the dental profession. But with African Americans and Native Americans, it's the worst. And we need to do a much better job of that. The other problem we have with the dental workforce is students getting out of school are an enormous amount of debt. I have students that I interview for positions who are graduating from dental school as much as $300,000 in debt. Now, they're not the typical student. The average student at a private school is over $150,000 in debt 2 years ago, but the amount of debt these individuals are grading for dental school is just unbelievable. And when you have someone in that amount of debt going into having a choice between going into public health or private practice, you know where they're going to go. And when they go into private practice, what do you think is uppermost in their mind? Improving access to dental care for low-income people? Oh, how do I pay off my dental bills so I can have a life of my own?
You mean their dental debt from
yes.
their school?
Yeah,
you mean their dental school debt?
Yes,
correct.
Dental debt. And it puts them in a very awkward position as health professionals.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. My guests today are Myron Aloukian and Alice Horowitz, and we've been discussing oral health in America. After the break, we'll continue the discussion, focusing on the gaping disparities in access to dental care between rich and poor in the U.S. Then, later in the show, Paul Zeitz, director of the Global AIDS Alliance, will be joining us to discuss the president's proposal to increase our humanitarian aid directed toward the HIV crisis in the poor nations of the global South. So stay tuned. Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guests today have been Myron Aloukian and Alice Horowitz, experts in the area of public health dentistry. During this interview, we have periodically referred to a landmark report on oral health published by the Surgeon General of the United States in the year 2000. It is easily located through the National Institutes of Health website, nih.gov. Now back to the second part of the interview. Earlier in the show, Dr. Aloukian, you mentioned what a high percentage of people have suffered from dental caries and decay.
Yes.
And you briefly mentioned, I think, a statistic about a large number of people at age 75 having several teeth
decay.
That are missing, actual missing
yes,
teeth.
Yes, missing and new tooth decay.
Speaking as someone who's practiced internal medicine in both wealthier and not-so-wealthy communities, it strikes me that the issue of missing teeth is very strongly socially distributed, and it
no
seems
question.
To me,
yeah.
And I was wondering if you could comment on disparities in how we're doing in terms of dental public health in this country.
Well, let's deal with people with no teeth whatsoever over age 65. I don't have those figures right in front of me, but I think there's something like, for the general population, it's 30%. For the low income, it may be 40 or 45%. Over age 65 have no teeth. And if you're higher income, the percentage would be much less than 30, but I don't have those figures at my fingertips. In terms of access to oral health in general, there's no question that low-income children, the data has shown that low-income children, I'm talking ages 2 to 5, have almost 5 times more tooth decay than high-income children, that when you're talking about dental sealants, that 14-year-old white children have 4 times more dental sealants than African-American children. When you're talking about untreated disease among certain minorities like American Indian and Alaskan Native children, they have age 2 to 4, they have 6 times more tooth decay than white children. And when you're talking about oral cancer, African American males have almost 2 times more oral cancer mortality than whites. And you know, there are major disparities by race. There are major disparities by income. A study done a couple of years ago by the General Accounting Office showed that kids on Medicaid, only 20% of kids on Medicaid in this country were getting dental care. And this is a mandated service by the federal government. And there are many reasons for that, and people have worked on it a bit since then. But that's unconscionable that we're not providing these services to people, even when they're covered with federal and state funding. And part of the problem is the provider issue, getting the providers, the dentists, to provide services. Why would a dentist want to treat a child on Medicaid when they're going to get one-third to one-half the fee they would get on a child not on Medicaid?
In the Surgeon General's report, they surveyed people on who have not seen a dentist in 2 years or in a relatively long period of time. I can't remember the interval. But if you exclude people who think their teeth are perfectly okay or who have no teeth at all, what the survey showed was that the greatest obstacle by far was cost.
Mm-hmm.
Does that surprise you?
No.
No, it doesn't surprise me.
Mm-mm.
On this show today, I've heard the issue of community health centers mentioned. I've heard you talk about provider reimbursement through the Medicaid program. Are those the two most important interventions to improve access?
I'd say the probably the best way to improve access for kids is school-based dental programs. Would you agree with that, Alan?
Yeah, I would.
If the best way to improve access for kids to dental care in this country, especially high-risk kids, would be a school-based dental program where you provide dental care at the school for the child. That eliminates the necessity of the parent leaving work to take the child in, and it provides a presence for all the kids in the school, and you can do oral health education for the kids and do role modeling and everything. That would be the ideal thing.
And what percentage of schools have school-based dental?
Very few. If it's more than 5%, I'd be surprised.
What about adults who really want to seek care but just can't afford it, have no health insurance or at least no health insurance that would cover dentistry, and are poor? What's the best intervention to help those people?
Well, if they need dental care, I mean, they can do the oral hygiene and brush their teeth and floss and all of that, but if they have a cavity and need care, they have to have a dentist treat them. And if they have no money and no one's willing to treat them, then they're stuck unless they live in a community where there's a community health center that would be willing, that is able to provide it to them at low cost or no cost, or unless the city or town or state has some program for adults that provides low cost or free dental care. Now, there are some communities, and it's usually in your smaller communities where everyone in town knows each other, and those dentists have a sense of social responsibility. And in those communities, the average dentist would be willing to provide some services to people that just can't afford it because they're a member of the community, and they identify with their community. But when you're in a major city and there's no sense of accountability or responsibility to the community by the health providers, it's more difficult to do that. Now, there are some cities and states where the dentists have organized and have provided free or low-cost services to people in high need. But if someone needs more than getting out of pain or more than one or two fillings, you know, it's very difficult for those folks to get services. Another possibility is going to dental schools and getting dental care in the dental school, but even
that's not
in the
free,
dental
though.
School, it's not free.
Mm-mm.
You have to pay for the service. It may be lower than in a private office, but you still have to pay for the service.
And what about the elderly? Does Medicare provide coverage for dental care?
No
dental care under Medicare alone, unless it's related to cancer of the oral cavity or unless it's related to trauma. for basic services, there is no dental care covered under Medicare.
What percentage of the U.S. population has dental insurance? And do you think that that is an important intervention for the society to get that to occur?
I don't know the exact figure, but it's probably about 50%. But even though 50% have it, it may not be basic coverage, but limited coverage. You have a certain percentage that have pretty decent coverage, and I don't know what that figure is. And then you have another percent that has some, but not basic or not comprehensive.
It really varies. I think whatever number we say that they might have dental insurance, some of it is so little, like may only pay for tooth cleaning and maybe x-rays, but it doesn't pay for much else. So, you know, it's highly variable and quite expensive.
Now, I guess I'm interested in asking you, what do you think the most important interventions the society as a whole could take, say government, to improve oral health? And I guess I heard you say school-based clinics. That sounds like it would be on your list. What other interventions would come to mind?
Well, I'd say the most important is community water fluoridation and getting community water fluoridation to those 90 to 100 million people who do not have fluoridated communities. Then the other thing I would recommend is some sort of a school program that includes dental care and sealants for kids.
And Dr. Horowitz, what would you say?
I would echo those two, and also we would like oral cancer exams on anyone who uses tobacco 18 years of age and older, and for all adults 40 years of age and over annually.
Let me also add, you also need to have all community health centers in this country have dental programs.
Excellent point.
Because they deal with high-risk populations that don't have access to most health services. And if you have community health center dental programs, school-based dental programs and prevention programs, and community water fluoridation, you're going to be making a much greater impact on oral health in this country than we've been able to do up to this point.
The Surgeon General's report on oral health emphasized the importance of people who are in the oral health fields and in public health of attempting to educate policymakers and people in government
right.
on the importance of supporting programs to improve oral health. Do you think that our effort in public health to get the policymakers aware of oral health issues, has our effort been successful?
I think we have a long way to go. I think it has been helpful in terms of educating policymakers up to a point, but that has to be done on a regular basis and sustained over a period of time. And when we have so many states that have such high deficits, and when the federal government is in a deficit situation with budgets, and you have more and more people cutting back programs, for example, some 25 states have cut their dental programs because of budgetary problems. That affects millions and millions of people, and that's just within the last year. And, you know, the Surgeon General's report came out in 2000, and we've been saying how important oral health is. But when it comes to cutting budgets, dental is often one of the first to go because we still have a long way to go to educate people about its importance. And it can't be decision makers. Decision makers listen to themselves, the experts, and the public. And we've really got to get the public to be much more vocal about the importance of this. The problem is, the people with the greatest need are the least vocal and the least able to educate the decision makers. So, you know, you get a biased source of information that goes to decision makers, and those are people who are usually more educated, more sophisticated, and have more money, and they're the ones who are also getting the dental care, and they don't see why there's a problem.
I'd like to thank you both for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Okay,
thank you.
Coming up next, Paul Zeitz joins us to discuss the Bush administration proposal to increase international aid designated for the AIDS epidemic. So stay with us. In his State of the Union message of late January, the President presented two major new initiatives. On our last airing of Public Health Radio, we explored one of the initiatives, a $679 billion tax cut, and its implications for public health. Interested listeners can access that through our website, publichealthradio.org. During the same speech, Mr. Bush introduced another program, a $15 billion aid program to combat the HIV epidemic. Though this proposal is vastly smaller than the tax cut, it was nonetheless welcomed by many AIDS activists. To evaluate this new AIDS proposal, we're joined by Paul Zeitz. Dr. Zeitz is a medical doctor who has worked for over a decade in Africa with the UN AIDS Initiative, the CDC, and the World Health Organization. He is a co-founder and executive director of the Global AIDS Alliance, a coalition of civic groups which focuses on the HIV epidemic, especially in the Global South. Paul Zeitz, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thanks for having us.
Now, for years, those of us who've been concerned with the HIV pandemic have been pretty saddened by the minimal amount of aid that the whole crisis has received from the developed countries, and especially the United States. Now the president has promised $15 billion over 5 years, and this does seem to be in the ballpark of what activists have been demanding. Do you know why there's been so little aid given up until now, and why the recent change of heart in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, throughout the 1990s, there was a dramatic reduction in overseas development assistance from the United States and other wealthy nations to the Global South in general. I think after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was a sense that the need to invest in the world, or some of the dynamics that increased investment, like trying to counterbalance Soviet investment, were gone. And so there was a general decline overall in overseas development assistance throughout the 90s. In terms of the U.S., and just to give you another point of perspective, until 1998, there was only about $200 million from all sources going into the AIDS response in Africa. It was so drastically underinvested in. It's quite striking. Now, in the late 90s, with the leadership of the Clinton administration, there was a doubling and then a tripling. So by this year, there's about a baseline spending from the United States of about $1 billion per year for global AIDS programs. I think as the new century has started, there's been a recognition of that, the impact of the divide between the wealthy North and the impoverished South. And AIDS is certainly a manifestation of global economic injustice. And the impact that has on the whole world, I think, is becoming more aware. What was the change of heart now? I think President Bush has been aware of the AIDS epidemic since the time, at least, of his campaign. And there's been a broad activist movement trying to convince this administration to take up a response. Now, President Bush's announcement, he includes this $1 billion of baseline spending per year and then adds $10 billion over 5 years. So it's a total of $15 billion over the five-year period. Now, the following week after the State of the Union address, we got some more details about how he plans to implement his program, and there's a major concern in that he is planning to backload the funding. So for 2003, the funding is staying around $1.2 billion. In 2004, he's proposing the spending only go up modestly to about $1.6 billion. And so the real increase into multi-billion dollar spending doesn't occur until 2007 and 2008. We're very concerned about that backloading of the spending, because what that means is that the money won't really hit the ground into programs in Africa to save people's lives until the out years, and then millions more people are going to die in the interim. So we believe the funding should be front-loaded. There should be $3 billion this year, $3 billion next year, et cetera, et cetera. And that would dramatically increase the level of funding going into the response. It could be absorbed now effectively through mechanisms like the Global Fund and have a great impact.
Now, is our $15 billion figure likely to actually get appropriated by Congress? What has been the U.S. Congress's record on the issue?
Well, there is a strong bipartisan support in the United States Senate for drastically increased spending. And we have a lot of work to do there, you know, with the Budget Committee and the Appropriator Committee. However, there is some, you know, there because of Senator Frist's leadership and strong Democratic leadership, there seems to be some optimism that these levels of funding can make it through the Senate. We're more concerned, frankly, with the House of Representatives, and there does not seem to be a strong support with the House of Representatives leadership, Hastert and others, Tom DeLay, others like that, don't seem to be very committed to this issue right now. And the appropriators are also less inclined to increase spending in these areas as well.
I know that the U.S. gives the smallest portion of its gross domestic product to humanitarian aid of all the developed countries, but it seems like when it's coming to HIV, the other countries don't seem to be stepping up to the plate to get the UN Global Fund adequately financed. Is that what is the discrepancy there?
Well, I think that there are different approaches to development assistance, and I think, for example, the Norwegians and the Danish and the Swedes, who have the highest investment as a proportion of GNP, have very strong bilateral programs where they invest directly in a variety of countries, and they implement their aid in a different way. For example, the British has a very strong development model called a sector-wide approach that they're heavily investing in throughout Africa, and they're doing it directly between the government of Britain and with recipient countries. These countries also do invest in international mechanisms like the UN agencies and so forth, and I think that they have stepped up to the plate with the Global Fund. The Global Fund is a new mechanism, and now everyone is moving towards a much higher level investment in it so that it can continue its good work.
Now, the Bush proposal designates a relatively small fraction of the aid into the UN Global Fund, and as you pointed out, that since it's backloaded, it'll only be increasing gradually. I'd like to ask you, do you know why the president is avoiding the Global Fund? I think it was only 10% of the increased aid.
Yes, that's our second major concern, is that the president heavily favors spending U.S. funds through U.S. government agencies, like the U.S. Agency for International Development, the Centers for Disease Control, etc. And we've been advocating for a balanced approach between investing in the U.S. government agencies and in mechanisms like the Global Fund, which is actually not, it's independent of the UN, it's independent of the World Bank, it's independent of all of the wealthy nations' control. It's a partnership mechanism that has representatives from wealthy nations and recipient governments, as well as civil society and the private sector. The president, the feedback that we've gotten is that the president and his close staff that helped design this initiative felt like they needed to have control over how the resources were spent. There was a sense of we can do it kind of spirit, and they came up with an approach that they think they can deliver and that will achieve results. And the initiative has some really strong points in terms of setting really strong targets. We're concerned, though, that it's out of balance and that we're working with the Congress to hope they'll fix the initiative to make sure that the president invests in this multilateral mechanism.
Why is it important to support the Global Fund? What can they do that we can't with bilateral aid that goes directly from our country to the others?
Well, I think we've learned from over the last 30 years, when there are global health crises, the U.S. has an important leadership role in order to deal with them. However, we've also learned that the best way to do it is to work in partnership through multilateral mechanisms. The best example is the Global Smallpox Eradication Program. That was clearly driven by U.S. leadership from CDC, but it was implemented through the World Health Organization. Same with the Global Polio Eradication Program. U.S. leadership, but implemented through the World Health Organization. And I think the global community of experts have said neither the World Bank or the UN agencies can implement the kind of response that we need for HIV/AIDS. And so that's why they've collectively created this thing called the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria. And the reason why is that the Global Fund is able to marshal the actions of the diverse array of partners, both locally in country and globally, towards supporting one common strategic plan. I lived and worked in Zambia for many years in the 90s, and we had, for example, 30 different donors that were providing resources for HIV/AIDS. You couldn't imagine a more chaotic, uncoordinated, dysfunctional response. And what the Global Fund is doing right now, and I've been to 5 countries in the last several months in Africa, and I've been extraordinarily optimistic about the momentum that's been catalyzed and everybody working together towards implementing one common plan to achieve measurable results. It also pulls everyone together into one common implementation activity that everyone holds each other accountable for. When everyone's sort of off doing their own thing, the level of accountability is hard to maintain for all the separate streams of money. But when everyone's working together, then everyone holds everyone else accountable. And that we have some really good examples of how that model has worked in Africa, and that's why the Global Fund is really changing reality. The other major point is that the Global Fund is able to provide resources to pay for salaries, to pay for services, like the recurrent cost of those services. It also can procure commodities like drugs at best world prices. Historically, the U.S. government it's very difficult for any U.S. government agency to provide money for salaries and for the recurrent cost of programs. And our procurement requirements frequently, because of congressional intent, require that we buy American products. And those products are not best world prices.
Can you recommend a website or two for listeners who wish to learn more about this issue?
Yes, I would like to recommend www.stopglobalaids.org. That's a website that educates people about the need to stop the epidemic, some steps that can be taken, and it invites people to become part of an action network that keeps them up to date with happenings in Washington and around the world that are critical for their involvement.
And finally, you clearly stated that you think that the UN Global Fund should be included, and you're obviously concerned about the backloading of the aid. You mentioned earlier that you were concerned that the House might significantly reduce the amount of aid, and I was wondering what you would wish listeners to do on this issue.
Well, I think it's critical for all listeners, first of all, to support Senator Leahy. For example, he's been a great leader in this issue, and he needs to be shored up, and his constituents need to let him know that they appreciate his leadership on this issue. We also know that Senator Schumer and Clinton and Jeffords have also been involved and supportive. They haven't really taken this on as one of their priority issues, but they're always very supportive. I think also your Vermont listeners have an opportunity with Governor Dean's candidacy to ask him to continue to speak out the way he started to do, and to hold all the presidential candidates, and including President Bush, to really deliver on these promises. I think there's a really unique opportunity here for your listeners to make sure that that President Bush is held accountable for delivering on the great rhetoric that we heard at the State of the Union.
Well, Paul, I'd like to thank you for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Thanks a lot, Marvin.
Well, that's it for today's show. For those of you who may wish to listen to past shows, I invite you to explore our website, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and please join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.